and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Jordan Calhoun, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Megan Walbert, Lifehacker's managing editor.
And today we're learning more or less how to hack your marriage, right?
Yeah, and that might not sound too romantic, but here to help us is psychologist Eli Finkel.
There might be periods of our life where, I don't know, there's young kids at home, or there's a cancer diagnosis, or there's incredible stress at work, where we don't have the bandwidth to invest in the relationship, to do all the things that are, on average, beneficial for the relationship, but we're not ready yet to let go of our aspirations. It's like, how can we keep things strong in the really sort of intense periods where we're not able to invest as much as we want in the relationship, but we're not ready to let go of our aspirations? And that's where love hacks have their major power.
Eli is a psychologist and professor at Northwestern University, as well as the director of Northwestern's Relationships and Motivation Lab. His research focuses on romantic relationships in American politics and sometimes where they intersect.
Eli is also the author of the best-selling book, The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work, which details some pretty interesting research back ways to improve your marriage.
And so, Megan, you are married, right?
I am married, yes.
You are indeed married. How long have you been married?
In a couple of weeks, it will be 13 years.
13 years. My God.
13 years. Which is funny because when I think, so I got married when I was 26 years old, which seemed perfectly old at the time. But now when I look back, I'm like, we were kind of young.
Yeah.
I mean, 26 is kind of young, I feel like.
Yeah. You're still learning a lot about yourself at 26, or at least I was. I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you had to explain to, you know, just me or tens of thousands of listeners, why you got married, but without using love, what would you explain as your reason for getting married?
Oh, interesting. Okay. I guess I would say partnership, companionship. Mm-hmm. And I think I would say growth. The person that I married is someone that I feel like I can grow with.
And that's so interesting when I put it in the context of what Eli speaks about in his book. He talks about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Have you heard of that before?
I hadn't before reading the book, no.
So for listeners who haven't heard of it before, imagine a pyramid that basically is blueprinting human fulfillment and what people need for it. And at the bottom of that pyramid, it's the simple things that we need for human fulfillment. Food, water, shelter, those basics. And the idea is that once you get to a certain level of that pyramid, you are then aspirational for the next rung of that pyramid until you get to the top of the pyramid, which is like growth and potential and sort of all these lofty ideas that fulfill us at our most. They like feed our souls as humans. So it goes from the basics, food, water, and shelter. The next rung up would be safety and health and wellness, things like that, financial security. Then above that would be friendships, romantic relationships, community, family. And above that would be a sense of purpose. And then ultimately, you know, you get to this growth and potential and all of these lofty ideas, right? And Megan, your answer sort of spanned that entire pyramid. You talked about—
I want all of those things, every single one of
them. Yeah, you want everything. You want so much
top to bottom.
You want so much from your— no pressure from your partner at all. You know, pressure for them.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really interesting to talk to Eli for many of us who want our marriages to give us all of these different things. It's going to take some either lowering expectations or what Eli describes as love hacks to sort of reconcile those things that you want from your relationship to those things that your relationship can ultimately offer you. And that's where I guess we can find happiness, is like having our expectations run a little bit closer to what it can actually give.
Yeah. And I think we, even if we have strong marriages that have low conflict, I think there's always some hacking we can do to our love.
Well, that's what we're all about with this podcast. So let's talk with Eli and figure out these love hacks to help our marriages.
Great. Let's do it.
So, Eli, welcome to The Upgrade. We're so glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So, before we start talking about how to have a better marriage, we should probably start with some context for marriage and how we got to the current view of marriage that's sort of popular, right? So, can you describe a brief history of why people get married and how it's evolved over the decades?
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the most fun things to explore when I was working on the book is, you know, we grow up into a certain cultural and historic moment and period, and we think, well, that's just the way things work. I guess lately we've seen some interesting high-profile changes, including the national legalization of gay marriage, for example. But yeah, I mean, one of the wild things is if you look across cultures, and even if you just look in the U.S., the functions of marriage, that is, what do people think that this relationship, that this institution is about, have just changed radically over the last, really, over the course of the nation.
So what was it like, say, you know, 50 to 100 years ago? What were the reasons that people got married, and what are the reasons that people get married now?
Yeah, I mean, the again, if we trust the historians and the sociologists, they tell us that the nation, including the colonial era, had three broad like eras of marriage. So going to the colonial era up until around the 1850s, they call it the pragmatic era. Of course, we're talking about the center of gravity for these beliefs. Obviously, not everybody had access to these types of freedoms and so forth. But broadly, the pragmatic era, marriage is about really basic survival needs. I mean, literally things like food, clothing, and shelter. Nobody was kissing somebody goodbye and heading to the office, or you know, trying to marry my best friend. Those ideas would have been laughable. And so if you think of this in terms of, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we were looking at the bottom, right? Literally things like physiological and safety needs, not freezing, having enough food. Marriage was about that. Largely, it was nice to love your partner and have a good sex life, but that wasn't the point. And it really wasn't until about the 1850s with, you know, broad industrialization that you started seeing a big shift in that. For the first time, people start to think that the individual fulfillment of the spouses, of the partners, was a major function of marriage. And really, they wanted to marry for love. The idea had been around for a while, but it was impractical. And starting around 1850, increasingly, people wanted to marry for love. And in terms of Maslow's hierarchy, now we've ascended to the middle level. And that was the dominant thread up until really the 1950s, when we got it all figured out and everything was perfect. And we finally were able to live this dream that we had looked for generations, which is the breadwinner, homemaker, love-based vision of marriage, where, you know, she has her sphere of domestic life and he has his sphere of, let's call it, work life. And they have their little suburban house and 3.5 kids around then. And they thought that was going to be the end of it and everyone was going to be thrilled. And they really were not. They found it stifling if it had been the case that women had, you know, women fundamentally need to be nurturant but not assertive, and men fundamentally need to be assertive but not nurturant, then maybe that solution would have worked. But really what they did is they cleaved the human psyche in half, and men and women both thought, this is bogus. And then you're now getting to our era, starting around 1965 to the present, which I call the self-expressive era. Now we're looking at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, way up there for self-actualization, and we think, even if we're in love with the person, we think this is a good man and a good father and I love him, but I feel stagnant, I'm not growing, and I'm not going to stay in this relationship for the next 30 years. And really, it's about this sense of self-expression, authenticity, and personal growth, and that's a big priority these days.
So it sounds to me like our definition of compatibility has changed over the years. So I'm curious what you think. What makes a compatible partnership in this day and age? How do you know if you're going to, or how can you predict that I'm going to have a good marriage with this person?
Well, to the degree that you know, this particular pair of people adhere to this self-expressive vision of marriage, then compatibility will largely be about, yes, love and some of the more basic stuff. But increasingly, it's also about, do you bring out the authentic, real, true version of me? Am I growing toward the version of me that I really value and I feel is really true? And that's a different set of standards. I mean, we can look back, say, even going back to the 1950s or so, we can talk about, you know, the standards that mattered then. And certainly they cared about personal fulfillment and love back then. But the idea that you might leave a relationship where love is strong because of some ineffable self-expressive failure, that would have been kind of ludicrous. Today, that's really an essential part of all of it.
When I think about a successful marriage, I think back to this, you know, old statistic that we all have probably heard a million times a long time ago. I don't know how accurate it is anymore, but it's like, you know, 50 or 51% of all marriages end in divorce. Is that statistic actually still true today? And is there more nuance that people should take into consideration with that statistic? And are there other ways that we should like look at and redefine success with more sophistication than just whether it ends in divorce or not.
Yeah, your instinct that there might be some nuance there is a good one. So broadly speaking, those statistics are not crazy. So these like 1 in 2 marriages end in divorce. The best recent estimates we have is something like 43%. Turns out that demographers put a lot of time into this. It turns out to be not that easy to answer the question, because for every marriage that happens in 2021, you'll need to wait something like 75 years to know whether they ended in death or divorce, right? So people are giving their best estimates that they can. Those estimates are a little lower than in the past. So we don't have skyrocketing divorce rates. Circa 1980, the divorce rate was about 50%. Now it's about 43%. And one of the really striking differences, and this will resonate with other aspects of American life, is that there is great inequality. And so if you look at people who have a college degree, let's say, you know, middle class or upper class people, the divorce rate is not only down from its high, but pretty low. So that is something like 1 in 5 among people where both parties have college degrees are divorced within 20 years. Whereas among people who have just a high school degree, and especially among people who don't have a high school degree, the divorce rates are really much higher, something like 50, 60% or even more. The second part is, you're right, that just divorce, not divorce, is I don't think very many of us would say that's an acceptable criterion for saying this marriage was successful or not. I think a lot of people would say that the marriage has to last and in some meaningful way be fulfilling for both partners. My own view is maybe a little bit more radical than that, which is, I don't know that a marriage has to last forever as long as it has been fulfilling for the time that it has been together. But people will differ in their definitions. And in my field of, you know, the empirical research looks at both of those variables. Is it persisting over time rather than breaking up? Is it fulfilling for both members of the couple?
So you have a whole section in your book called Love Hacks. And this is one thing that we really wanted to talk with you about, because there's some serviceable items in here that we can walk through for anyone who is trying to figure out how to improve their marriage or to make it last, as we've talked about. So I know there's one that you mentioned, I believe it's called making external temporary attributions for your partner's bad behavior. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that looks like in practice?
Yeah, I probably needed a PR consultant when I went with that language. Yeah, so the idea behind that particular one is predicated in a fundamental truth that all of us understand and few of us internalize, which is our subjective experience of reality in real time is not the identical thing, is not identical to the objective reality as it exists. And so if we find ourselves, for example, angry or hurt by a given thing that our partner did, we don't feel like, it's a little arbitrary. My hurt and anger doesn't, I don't have to be hurt and angry. But the reality is that the extent to which we are hurt or angry by our partner's behavior is immensely determined by the way we interpret it. And so if our partner has done something disrespectful, let's say she told a story at a dinner party that we thought had been a secret and it sort of embarrassed us, we have a broad range, we have broad latitude for how we get to interpret what she did. And so when I say making external attributions for negative behaviors, we can say it's something about her. Like, my partner is just an incredibly inconsiderate person, and she's always been like this. And I'm just profoundly disappointed that somebody that's so important in my life is just such a lousy person in this way. Or we could say she'd been drinking and she probably didn't realize that this was so personal to me. And does it matter? Again, I know the evidence on this. Does it matter in terms of how I feel about the relationship, how ultimately she feels about the relationship, the story that I tell myself about why she did what she did? That's what an attribution is. It's an explanation of why somebody did what she did or he did or they did. And so one of the things that we can do, and I call these love hacks because they're quick and dirty things that we do that we don't need to work hard at. We don't need to coordinate with our partner. It's just, can we look more generously at what our partner did? And so this external attribution for negative behavior is that exact example of trying to interpret the negative things that our partner did as being more temporary, as being not really about a personality flaw in the individual, rather something maybe more situational or circumstantial. Do you guys mind if I take a brief detour to say why I think love hacks matter?
Absolutely.
So once we realize how our expectations of marriage have shifted over time, that there were no two tablets that came down from Mount Sinai that said, thou shalt ask the following things of your marriage, but rather a very historically and culturally contextualized set of norms and expectations, well, then you have a lot of freedom. Like, it's very empowering to say, I get to choose, like, what are the things that are really important for us? And the two of us get to choose together. Each of us as individuals get to choose. But that whole logic boils down to a supply and demand story. Basically, we get to make demands of our marriage. And I know that a lot of people are saying, don't ask so much. Asking so much is bad. That's false. If you're not asking for much, you're unlikely to get it. And so there's a lot to be said for having high expectations of your relationship. The problem is when you have expectations that the marriage can't meet. And yes, that is setting yourself up for disappointment. And this is where we get to supply and demand. The demand is, what are the needs, goals, expectations that you have of your marriage that say, these are the things I'm going to expect from you. And if I get them, I'll be happy. And if I don't get them, I'll be disappointed. And compare them to, given the nature of our relationship and my partner's skills and preferences, are these things realistic? And so this is one of the major points of the book, is we should ask a lot of our marriage, especially in the ways that play to our strengths. We should ask less of the marriage, where we're comfortable doing so, about places where we're really not playing to the strengths of the relationship or our partner. Things that are chronic sources of sadness or disappointment are things that we might just want to let go of hoping for. And the reason why I'm so excited about the love hack idea is there might be periods of our life where, I don't know, there's young kids at home, or there's a cancer diagnosis, or there's incredible stress at work, where we don't have the bandwidth to invest in the relationship, to do these date nights, to have regular sex, to do all the things that are on average beneficial for the relationship, but we're not ready yet to let go of our aspirations. It's like, how can we keep things strong in the really sort of intense periods where we're not able to invest as much as we want in the relationship, but we're not ready to let go of our aspirations? And that's where love hacks have their major power, is we can, without exerting much time or energy, sustain a reasonably high level of marital quality until we're able to do the heavy investment stuff.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Another thing that you discuss in your book that we actually had a recent episode on was about the growth mindset. And yeah. Relationships force people to grow together. Like, it forces you to grow as an individual and to be able to, you know, work in partnership with another person. How do people navigate that? Are there ways that people can communicate or things that people should be considering in order to implement a growth mindset, not only on themselves, but with someone else who also has to adhere to the same type of mindset in order to make that type of progress?
Right. Again, if you're sort of coordinating with your partner, you're beyond the love hacks part of my book. You're in another part of my book, which is like
we
actually working with your partner. Yeah. But in the love hack side, like that's really about us. The love hack, I mean, one of the things I really like about the love hack idea is these aren't time-consuming things, and they aren't things that require coordination, right? Like there's other parts of the book where I say, here's how to communicate better, and here's the importance of date nights, and you want to have a hotter sex life, like these are things you might try. The love hacks are specifically meant to be quick and dirty things. That doesn't mean they're easy. Like, reorienting our thinking is not an easy thing to do, but in principle, they're not time consuming. Yes, this growth mindset thing, and people have explored this idea. That this is an idea that really was cultivated and developed in a different context by Carol Dweck, who's a Stanford professor. But the idea is, like, you know, a given attribute. So she did research on intelligence, right? And so the idea is people differ in the extent to which they think intelligence is sort of fixed. Is it carved into stone and you either have a certain amount or you don't? Or is it something that you can cultivate? That is, is it an entity? Is it something that's fixed, or is it malleable? And it turns out, and now there's really good evidence this across a bunch of different contexts, that if you think that intelligence is something that you can develop, you react better when you have an academic failure, right? Like you did badly on a math exam. Well, what does that mean? Well, here again, we're telling ourselves a story. Is this a story that I'm bad at math? That's a like a fixed way of thinking. Or is this a story about how, huh, I really didn't do that well on that one. Good thing intelligence is malleable because now there's opportunities for improvement. Well, there's a lot of work, including some from our own lab, on growth mindsets. This, again, the same general idea. Sometimes we use different language. But to what extent are relationships fixed? That is, you're either, you know, compatible or you're not. Or are relationships malleable? That is, something that you can actually improve on. And it turns out that, like, let's say you and I have a big fight. Well, what does that fight mean? What did the math exam failure mean? Does it mean that I'm stupid? Does it mean that you and I are fundamentally incompatible? Or does it mean, huh, we just learned something about each other that we didn't really know was going to happen, and this is an opportunity. And so we can actually now have a conversation. And in fact, not only is conflict not necessarily some global indicator that we're not compatible, but it is an opportunity for us to understand each other better and come out even stronger. And so we have some control. I don't want to say infinite control, but we have some control over how we think about events in our relationship. Good events, bad events. Do they mean, uh-oh, it's looking like the fates are giving us a lesson about whether we actually have a future, or is it saying, huh, that wasn't that fun. I didn't necessarily enjoy the ride. You hurt my feelings. But this is an opportunity for us to talk and learn from each other and, in fact, maybe grow closer.
You know, while we're talking about conflict, every marriage is going to have conflict to some degree, whether it's a lot or whether it's minimal, it's going to be there at some point. So how can you talk about taking this sort of neutral third party perspective toward, you know, thinking about the conflicts that you've had and moving past them? Can you talk a little bit about that, what that looks like in practice?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to tell you briefly about the study. This is one of the favorites that we've done in our lab. So we recruited 120 married couples from Chicago and Evanston, the sort of Chicago area. And everybody wrote about the biggest conflict that they'd had over the previous 4 months. They did this 7 times over a 2-year period. And then in the second year, we randomly assigned half of the couples to do this thing that I call the marriage hack, this think about the conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody. And, you know, we were delighted when we saw the results, which is that people who did that 7-minute writing task of not just talking about the conflict, but then taking 7 minutes and saying, all right, what if I had to think about the conflict, not from my own eyeballs, from my own vantage point, which is our default, but from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody. And those people's marriages did significantly better over the second year of the study because they had done this writing task. Why do we think that works? Well, look, we're doing some ongoing research to figure out exactly what the mechanisms are. But I think, you know, I think all of us have a pretty good instinct for why that effect might be there, which is we tend to interpret the world in self-serving ways, just on average. I don't want to say people are bad and self-interested and so forth, but the reality is that we have a particular vantage point on reality, and that vantage point on reality will be our default, and it should be. It's totally reasonable, but it's not always the one that is going to be most conciliatory, most capable of thinking broadly, like, yeah, well, I was kind of a jerk too, right? That's not the first thought we have. That's the second thought we have if we're taking the time and effort to do it, to realize, yeah, okay, I understand that, you know, I'm still upset with you because you did hurt my feelings and I thought that was disrespectful, but I understand why from your perspective, you know, I had kind of started it by teasing you in ways that I didn't intend to be as harsh, but that really hurt your feelings in front of other people. And it's this third party perspective that says, look, it's not like your perspective is more valuable than mine, but it's not nothing. And is there a way that we can account for my perspective and your perspective at the same time from the vantage point of somebody who really wants things to go well? And what's neat about that study is we didn't ask people to have some big, hard conversation. You know, we didn't train them on communication skills or understanding or how to listen. We just said, think about conflict that way from this neutral third-party perspective. And not only were people more satisfied over time in their relationship, but they actually had a hotter marriage. They actually had more passion in their relationship, which we didn't really expect. But it turns out that if you think better about these conflicts, they don't spiral as much and the relationship in general gets better.
This reminds me of something my mother-in-law always says, which is, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?
Yeah.
You know, taking that step back and, you know, saying, well, you know, maybe I'm right in certain ways, but maybe he's right in certain ways too.
Your mother-in-law is onto a profound truth, and I'm aware of that saying as well. I think it is profoundly, profoundly deep. One of the points that I think all of us need to acknowledge here, and I do acknowledge it explicitly in my book, is there's a caveat that we never bother to say, which is our partner is not fundamentally abusive. And this is a set of decisions. This is sort of an assessment of the relationship and of the partner that you have to make separate from all of these things, because almost all of the things that we can do to make our relationship stronger make us more vulnerable, right? That is, we don't get the privilege of having a maximally intimate, loving relationship and also being entirely protected from hurt feelings and exploitation. You don't get both. And so all of us need to go through some decision process where we, in this decision process, ends at an assessment of level of trust. Is it that we deeply believe this is a good person who wants the best for us, then I think we have a lot of latitude for improving the relationship that are predicated on that leap of faith. So your mother-in-law is exactly right, that you can either be right or you can be happy, and it presupposes that you're not being exploited or mistreated. And so I would urge everyone to adhere to your mother-in-law's worldview, under the caveat that this is true decency here at the core, and that this is a relationship I'd like to keep and sustain. If both parties are doing the I'd rather be happy than right, you're probably heading down a very, very healthy road.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of these are sort of small cognitive shifts to be able to be generous and practical when it comes to problem solving and working with another person. You talk about abstract reframing in your book, but you talk about it in the context of mitigating insecurity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. This is one of the cool studies. I'm just looking it up to refresh my memory on this. So we differ, all of us, in the extent to which we are, let's say, plagued by feelings of vulnerability. You know, so some of your listeners might be familiar with attachment theory. You know, if they took intro to psych, they would have encountered this stuff maybe. But in the adult context, some of us are, let's say, rejection sensitive. We are vigilant for signs that somebody doesn't love us. We feel that maybe that we're not worthy of being loved, some of us. And so it's difficult to get people who have this deep sense of insecurity, this sense like maybe I'm not that lovable, maybe my partner's, you know, doesn't think that great stuff of me. People who feel that way are pretty good at deflecting compliments, right? And your listeners can judge. Are you somebody who's always like, you know, when you get a compliment, no, right? You know, I don't like that. And partly, look, there's many reasons why we might be reluctant about compliments, but one of the reasons we might be reluctant is because if we are willing to sort of take it face value when our partner says, I love you and I'm so proud of you and you're wonderful, well, that makes us vulnerable for the reasons we were talking about earlier, right? If I let myself hope that you really love me, that you really think I'm decent and wonderful, well, then that means there's room for the fall. There's the possibility that I will learn that, no, it's not real. And so it's a little difficult to break through some of those insecurities. Like if we're involved in a relationship with somebody who has those insecurities, there's some difficulty in breaking through them. So let me actually find the exact wording here for the abstract reframing. So how do we get people who are more insecure to accept a compliment? Well, they had this condition in this one study by Denise Marigold and colleagues, where what you have to do is explain why your partner admired you. So think of a compliment your partner gave you. Now you have to think why, describe what it meant to you and its significance for your relationship. And then once people like had an explanation that they themselves were able to justify, they were able to internalize the compliment in a way that they weren't able to do by default.
You know, you also discuss the approach of not looking at your marriage as an all or nothing marriage, but instead looking for getting certain needs met through other relationships in your life. Can you explain how listeners can apply that approach?
If it's true that marriage is about calibrating our expectations to what we can realistically expect of ourselves, of our partner, of our marriage, then one of the things that most of us probably want to do is to figure out things we can do to ask less of the relationship, specifically in ways that don't play to the strengths of the relationship. And I've been a little bit disconcerted by how many high-level psychological and emotional needs we have thrown on this one relationship. it used to be that people hung out in same-sex crowds, that like your partner wasn't supposed to be your best friend. And certainly the idea of a soulmate didn't really exist, not as we think about it now. The idea that you're supposed to, you know, help me grow and live an authentic existence, like these are humongous asks. And so, yes, one of the things I talk about in the book is a constellation of ways that we can be strategic about what we're asking of the relationship and also what we're not asking of the relationship. And yes, one of the key ideas in there is, you know, is it the case that every time you complain about work, your partner gets really turned off and stops paying attention to you? Well, maybe that's something you don't need from this one person. Maybe there's somebody else that you can bitch about work to that will actually be more receptive and frankly, enjoy the conversation more than your spouse. There's no rule that says thou shalt ask, I'm in old English here, your spouse to do all of these different things. So we should just be strategic about how we use our own skills and our social networks to meet the needs that we have and to help other people meet their needs.
As we wrap up here, Eli, I want to ask you a question that's somewhat outside the scope of the book, and we'll see if you can have an answer for it. But when I think of a lot of our perceptions of what makes a happy and healthy relationship and what makes a good marriage, and all of our sort of preconceptions and assumptions that we have about marriage largely comes from pop culture. They come from the TV that we watch and the movies that we watch and the stories that we consume, right? Are there any portrayals that you especially love or hate for their depiction of marriage, for what makes a really good or a really sad or a really interesting marriage? Is there anything that you've read or watched recently that has impressed upon you or in some way related to some of the things that you've written in the book in a way that can be approachable for people?
You know, it's funny. I mean, sort of everything I watch ends up being grist for films for my class. I teach a relationship science class. One of the movies, I don't think it's been very widely watched, that was very powerful to me was, I think the name of the director is David Cianfrance. It's a 2010 movie called Blue Valentine. It's a lesser known one starring Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. And one of the things I love about it is it flashes back and forth between their incredibly beautiful, hot romance, and then 6 years later when the wheels have kind of come off the marriage. And I don't love the ending, but I begin my class by showing a couple clips and saying, how is it that this incredibly cute meet became this really difficult, stilted marriage that ultimately doesn't end up on a good trajectory? And so anyway, no, I don't have like a paragon that I hold up as the optimal thing to look at for all purposes, but I very much am interested in the depiction within pop culture of how relationships work and an understanding how things that start off with so much promise sometimes can sustain that promise and even grow it, and sometimes just entirely wither on the vine.
Well, Eli, thank you so much for this. This has been really great to hear. These love hacks are super practical and useful, and appreciate hearing your expertise in the book.
Jordan, Megan, thanks so much. It was really fun.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now it's time for Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. And I'm going to start with you, Eli. What's your upgrade this week?
My upgrade of the week is audiobooks.
Yeah.
I almost cannot believe that I get to wash dishes while Barack Obama reads his memoir to me at whatever pace I want. And when I'm like, wait, I spaced out a second, Barack, go back a little bit. No, triple speed, and I just,
yes.
What a time to be alive.
Do you use a particular app? Do you have a preferred audiobook?
So Libby, some of your listeners may be familiar with Libby. That's through the library, so that's free. And you know, I don't know how you feel about The Evil Empire, but Audible is also a terrific product from Amazon.
I use Libby and I absolutely love it. Megan, what is your upgrade this week?
Well, mine and Eli's can go together. I got my first pair of AirPods last week.
Nice.
And I know I'm late to this, but man, they're amazing. I put them in my ears and they know to turn on. I mean, I don't know why I waited so long, but I'm a big podcast listener. And so I can listen to the podcast that maybe I don't want my kid hearing while I'm cooking dinner, because it's going right into my ears. It's just wonderful.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Jordan, what about you? What's your upgrade?
My upgrade this week is I started a free trial for an app called Future, which is a virtual, well, it's a personal trainer app, but it's not a virtual sort of bot personal trainer app. It's actually a person. Like, my personal trainer lives in Philadelphia, apparently. And he records videos and sends me workouts through this app. And I have an Apple Watch, so it gets to track the steps that I take and how many calories I burn and whether I'm meeting my fitness goals and all that. And it's been a great experience so far. So one of the reasons that I have never gotten a personal trainer is because, one, it's always been too expensive. And two, because I felt like I only needed it for the accountability and I didn't really need much more than that. And this is sort of a happy in-between between having a personal trainer who I'm meeting in person, who's going to give me probably more than what I would need and more than I would be willing to pay for. And it's a medium between that and just having the accountability that I actually want. So it's been great using a personal trainer through an app, at least for the short term. We'll see if I stick with it long term. But so far, the app is called Future that I'm using right now, and it's been a good experience.
Sounds like a low maintenance way to get into that sort of pattern.
It's like the love hack of exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Just quick and dirty.
Quick and dirty. That's what today has been about. Quick and dirty, but also practical and efficient. And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review so others can find us. You can also reach us by calling 347-687-8109 and leave a voicemail or write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter @lifehacker, on Instagram @lifehacker.com. That's all one word. And of course on Facebook @facebook.com/lifehacker. You can find me on Twitter @JordanMCalhoun, Megan @MeganWalbert, that's MEGHANWALBERT, and you can also sign up, of course, you can also sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter, and you can find show notes for this and every great episode of The Upgrade by going to lifehacker.com and just searching for podcasts. See you next week.